for another intriguing edition of the Stack Pack. Perhaps you can help solve a mystery. What's up, guys? Season 5, episode 23. It's all three of us, Dan and Eli. Eli's in Dallas. Dan's, I don't know.
Hollywood,
he's
baby.
In Hollywood.
Hollywood, Florida, that is.
Hollywood, Florida. He's going to go get eaten by a gator, possibly fall into a...
sinkhole?
Sinkhole. Or he's going to get bitched at by a Republican.
Or all three.
I saw a video of a guy catching a small gator in his recycling bin.
Oh, yeah, I saw that too.
Oh, shit.
Oh, he might...
You know what's going to happen? What's going to happen? I'm going to fall into a sinkhole and get bitched at by a Republican gator.
Oh, that's on bath salts.
Wow.
And he married his cousin.
We got, this is a big ass episode. I say we just jump in.
Yeah, because we were going to kind of get into it before we even started recording. We're like, we should probably record all this.
Yeah, but we're not even – okay, so the first case we're talking about is this fucking crazy plane that exploded.
I have questions.
These men were members of the elite 101st Airborne Unit of the United States Army. On December 12th, 1985, they were among 248 young soldiers cut down in their prime. All killed instantly when their transport plane crashed in Gander, Newfoundland. It was the worst single air disaster in U.S. military history. Officially, the crash was written off to ice on the plane's wings. But many of the young men's families, as well as several key investigators, believe that the true cause of the Gander tragedy remains an unsolved mystery.
And they were apparently assigned to a peacekeeping force in the Sinai Peninsula. And of course, we all know that that's what the Army is best at doing, right? Keeping peace.
Yeah. Quotations.
Before the crash the previous day, the plane leaves Cairo, headed towards Kentucky, actually. They stopped over in Gander. That was the faithful stopover in Gander.
And then they're gonna take a gander at Gander.
And right after they take, that was like, that's where they had to stop in between because, you know, they crossed the ocean and such.
It was part of a 3-leg flight.
Yeah, they had to refuel.
They refueled in what, like Germany or something like that?
Stretch their legs.
No, they refuel at the airfield in Newfoundland. Or maybe there was one before that, but I don't know. It didn't say.
Yeah, it was part of a 3-leg tour.
So the
not a 3-leg tour, a 3-leg, you know, whatever.
They say the air crash was the single worst air disaster in U.S. military history. It occurred just 3 miles from the Gander control tower, and the wreckage was apparently spread across 1,300 feet long, 130 feet wide.
And this happened at takeoff.
Yeah, like they crashed like 3 miles from the airport.
Yeah.
So immediately a dude calls and he says he represents a terrorist organization, an Islamic Jihad terrorist organization. And they called the U.S. consulate in Algeria and said that they were responsible. But the U.S. just seems to very, I don't know, they're just like, oh, the U.S. says it. You know, they've discounted any possibility that they had anything to do with it, which is kind of weird. You know, like, what would make them think that they for sure didn't do it? You know, rather than maybe they did, but we can't prove it. Seems like they might have a better theory or something, or they might be responsible for it. I don't know. Right. So a Canadian Board of Inquiry states that there's ice on the wings, but, 4 of the board members also dissented this after claiming that there was no evidence that there was any ice on the wings. So that's weird. One person believed that there was evidence of an explosion on the plane.
An expert? Because I heard them, you know, give a lot of details about.
They're just vague. There's like a Canadian group of members and they talk about the members. Like some members thought this. Some members think that there was explosions on the inside. I don't know who these members are. I'm sure they were chosen and vetted.
Yeah.
They were just part of the Transportation Safety Board of Canada.
Member.
So one of the talking heads talks about something that confused me. I don't understand the point he was trying to make. He mentioned the because it was taking off, it had the tank was full of fuel, jet fuel. I don't understand if he was making a point that it shouldn't have crashed or it shouldn't have exploded like that. He mentioned something how the jet fuel hadn't had an opportunity to like mix with air, which would have caused an explosion.
Well, basically what he was trying to say is because, you know, fuel itself isn't explosive or combustible. Right. It's the vapor.
Yes.
So, you know, if a fuel tank is full, there's no room inside the fuel tank for vapor to start to accumulate.
Okay.
Whereas if the tank was half full, you know, it'd be half filled with, you know, jet fuel and then half fuel of jet fuel vapor.
I get it.
But that's kind of fucking bullshit because, you know, at the end of the day, if it gets hot enough, it will ignite.
It's right.
Fucking flammable.
And usually when there's crashes during takeoff, they're you know, survivable. Yeah.
But this one exploded.
It was just straight up exploded.
And then they mentioned that there was also some cargo possible on the plane. Like they mentioned these crates.
Description, he's like, well, there were boxes and missiles. And
have you guys seen Indiana Jones?
Little tins that looked like ammo cans that were ammo cans, but I wasn't sure if they were ammo cans, but they were ammo cans.
Yeah. The U.S. government says, claims that there's no evidence of any onboard explosion, but I mean, yeah, like planes just don't explode like that usually. And they also said that there was no, they also denied any explosives or ammunition that were, people thought there was some, maybe somebody stored some explosives that were not approved or something like that.
I mean, they were coming back from overseas. They could very well had, you know, weapons on board, like actual firearms, but as for ammunition itself, I don't think. So yeah. I could totally foresee that, you know, them discovering, you know, wooden boxes that were probably filled with, you know, firearms.
Yeah, but the government denies all that shit.
There was nothing like that there.
So eyewitness reports from Cairo seem to contradict the government statement. The 101st Airborne members waited for 8 hours before they were transported to a larger plane. The duffel bags of 41 of the soldiers were just left behind on the tarmac, so room could be made for these mysterious large wooden boxes. So a bunch of them just left their shit there. What people speculate is they might be highly classified weapons that nobody had the clearance to even know about. So they're just like, all right, you got to leave your shit here, and we're not going to tell you why.
Yeah, they're like smuggling all these like nuclear power weapons. They're smuggling plutonium.
The rescue worker that talks about the boxes is Harvey Day, and he says that there was 5 wooden boxes, and the officials prevented him from looking closer. And he seemed pretty persistent. They're like, we're going to have to arrest you. Go away. Yeah. But
nothing to see here.
He said he saw weapons, missiles, and ammunition boxes, which, I don't know, doesn't seem that out of the ordinary. It is just kind of weird that they had to leave their shit there. But Harvey also remembers that there was a super hot spot in the crash that, like, wouldn't get put out by fire. But, I mean, we're talking about jet fuel now. Like, I'm pretty sure it takes a little bit more than just, like, you know, it takes a while putting water on that shit.
Yeah, yeah. You know, that spot that could have kept flaring up could have been, you know, like a puddle of jet fuel. And if the surrounding area is hot enough to be the flash point for the jet fuel, as soon as you remove the water, it's going to reignite.
Several workers that helped with the cleanup started reporting health problems, symptoms that were pretty similar to radiation poisoning. One unnamed source says the government sealed records on the crash for 7 years. And, of course, they've all denied this shit.
They also said
they denied that any records exist at all, actually. Department of Defense and National Transportation Safety
Board. They also mentioned that what was odd and peculiar was that they cleared the area that the plane crash happened. That was cleared. Like they had to like demolish like the trees. And they said that it was due to like looters. Like they wanted to discourage looters. That's what they said.
They didn't want souvenir hunters to go out there.
Souvenir hunters. That's what it was.
Yeah, fucking souvenir hunter. That's so, yeah. It's like, really?
But I did find it odd. I'm like, okay, what are they hiding here?
But, I mean, it kind of makes sense because, like, look at the parents of one of the soldiers. Like, you know, they flat out asked the government, like, hey, can we have, like, pieces of it?
Oh,
yeah. So, you know.
So it's like, no, we don't want you guys going out there and getting pieces of the aircraft. Or anything. Yeah. Body parts, bones. Well,
So in the early 80s, the government began illegally selling arms to Iran in a covert operation known as the Iran-Contra, which is a pretty I mean, people know about that. I didn't know that's what that meant. That's crazy. But the operation was done in an attempt to free some hostage from the Middle East. So it's kind of, you know, shady on one thing and good on the other side, which is kind of pretty much the military and government yeah. in a nutshell, right?
Yeah, that's you're not wrong there.
You got to do a bunch of shady shit to do just a little good.
Yeah. And so that could have, you know, that could have led to people believing that somebody, that a bunch of, that a plane full of soldiers would might be a target. Apparently at the time of the crash, that operation, the Iran-Contra, was in jeopardy. And a few days before the crash, Colonel Oliver North warned that the U.S. was going to experience a bunch of new terrorism. And they say that the U.S. government officials did begin to act strangely after the crash. And for unknown reasons, the whole crash site was bulldozed. And they completely, yeah, like we said, we already said, they destroy the plane, which is super rare. They say they usually completely put the thing back together to see what happened.
Oh, yeah, yeah, totally.
In most all cases.
Like, for example, are you guys familiar of TWA Flight 800? Yeah, they just barely destroyed that aircraft.
Yeah, and that had happened, what, almost, like, that happened like a decade ago.
No. More. That was like 1990, 92, really? 93. Yeah. Yeah. TWA hasn't years. Existed in like fucking ever.
It was really that long ago? I don't know why I thought it was earlier or later. I don't know.
1996.
Yeah, that sounds about right. So I was thinking more like 2000. So yeah, 1996.
So think about that, like a civilian aircraft that crashed.
What, 15 years?
Was saved for that long, from 1996 to now. And this was a military aircraft crash. And they're just like, throw it in the dump. It's all good.
Yeah. Oh, and I said 15 years. 25 years, right? That's 25 years.
Oh, thank God the math isn't part of your job.
Oh, it is.
And thank God your job isn't part of like making sure helicopters don't fucking crash.
I'm
not at
work right now, man. I'm chilling with a whiskey. I've been off for a couple hours. I'm relaxed. I don't even want to say about work.
So basically that comment just basically proves we cannot trust you in like aviation expertise.
Oh, I will tell you right now, do not get in a helicopter. Just don't do it.
James Douglas Phillips was the soldier whose parents started like the organization to try to find out what happened. The group is called Families for the Truth About Gander, and they're the ones who called the government and got pieces of the aircraft. They were really surprised when they actually got it, but they said that they had an expert look at it, and the pieces were outward and the edges were puckered, and this indicated that the blast occurred inside the plane. So that's pretty interesting that this dad did more investigation, well, publicly, than the government. James Phillips' dad thinks that the explosion occurred in the air and then the plane broke apart and crashed. The autopsies also determined of all the soldiers that they definitely inhaled a bunch of carbon monoxide. Meaning that the fire or explosion was
inside
on the plane before it crashed. Yeah.
All that means is that they didn't die instantly. You know, they could have been alive when the plane fucking made contact and ignited and then died from carbon monoxide poisoning before they could, you know, get out.
How lethal? I mean, I know carbon monoxide is very lethal.
Well, if it immediately explodes, they all just die instantly.
Yeah, and also
not necessarily, like maybe at the center of the blast, but like, you know.
No, because carbon monoxide, like, think about it. When carbon monoxide is like in a garage, you can open the garage door and it dissipates, right? It's only when it's enclosed. So like
but you also got to think, like, we're thinking, like, you know, the plane just fell straight down to the earth and exploded like at a single point. Like, it crashed on a mountainside, you know, it probably hit a couple of trees before it finally made final, like, right, impact.
Well, yeah, they bulldozed the whole thing.
So, you know, there could have been a possibility that, you know, the first point of impact was like on a tree line, which ignited a fire inside the aircraft. And then the final impact is when it explodes.
It could have leaked jet fuel.
Yeah.
And then it would have
hit, like, there's air. There's a lot of variables. Like, I mean, the flight recorder on this aircraft was kind of shitty. All it could measure was like airspeed, throttle pull, and something else. Like, the cockpit didn't have it had a voice recorder, but like, it didn't work.
It says that many soldiers had significant amounts of carbon monoxide in their bodies. So I don't know. It's not specific enough to have.
Look, we're three guys that have day jobs that sit and drink whiskey and talk about true crime. We're not experts in this.
Yeah, like, yeah. I'm not an aviation expert, but I was reading on the Wikipedia how, like how they go into more details about, like, the crash. And from what the Wikipedia says, it's a little bit more believable that it was just, you know, pilot miscalculating the weight of the aircraft on takeoff. Because, like, the witnesses say it struggled, like, as it took off, it struggled to gain altitude before it crashed.
Well, that could be a lot of things. That could be the flight, like, lift mechanism. That could be just something stuck, a malfunction where it just won't go. Because when you get on an airplane, the wings shift, and so that way it can go up. And if that stuff's stuck, you're not going anywhere. You might pull up, and you're staying down.
So in 1990, a congressional hearing on the crash is convened in Washington. And while they do kind of talk shit about the government's shitty investigation, they don't recommend doing a new reinvestigation or anything. Weird. And the families are still upset. As far as suspects, there's the Islamic Jihad terrorist organization that claimed responsibility, but like military, like, nope, it wasn't them, which is fine. Some believe that an accidental explosion occurred on board due to illegal explosives being stored on the plane. I don't know.
Oh.
Maybe something flammable was in the wrong spot. Yeah, that's about it for this one.
Eli, I got a question for you. What is KIAS? K-I-A-S. Is that like known airspeed?
I don't know what that is.
It's an aviation term. Oh, known I've indicated never dealt with airspeed.
That. So what I do... I do with spare parts. We build our parts, and if somebody needs like a panel and shit, I have to research it and find out what panel was in them. I don't like. I'm not a. I do want to get my pilot's license, but I don't know.
So do I. So do I.
I think we should all get our pilot's license.
Oh, fuck yeah! $10,000. Let's do it.
I was going to tell you. You want to hear a sad story? One of the things that I read. I don't know if you guys read it too. One of the spouses of the, like, a sergeant that was on the plane, she found out that the plane had crashed from her 2-year-old. And the story that I read says that she showed her son where daddy was. She's like, oh, daddy's here right now. She showed him a map of where they were and where they were taking off. And she's like, oh, he's going to be here in 3 hours. Cause he had talked to her on the phone. He's like, hey, I'm going to be home in 3.5 hours, like, make dinner, whatever. So she's getting dinner ready. And then the 2-year-old comes into the kitchen as she's in the kitchen and says, daddy's dead. And she goes, what? 2-year-old. He shows her, he walks her to the living room. The TV is on the news, and they showed up the map the same map that she had showed her son.
Oh, man.
Where daddy Jesus is, Christ. They said the plane crashed, and he's like, oh, my dad, my mom just showed me. That's my dad's plane. And that's how she found out. Oh,
man, that's so heartbreaking.
Isn't that sad? That is heartbreaking. That is just like...
Oh, God.
She said it was like surreal. It was like a heartbreaking nightmare.
That sucks. Speaking of heartbreaking, let's talk about this Lost Loves, I guess. Peggy Lloyd is the daughter of Lee Curley Lloyd.
During the Second World War, more than 16 million American men and women were called upon to serve the country. Inevitably, many families would not survive the stress of wartime separation. 28-year-old Lee Curley Lloyd was one of those whose marriage was a casualty of the war effort.
He was serving his tour of duty when his wife divorced him and placed Peggy, her sister, and her brother, Arthur, in a boarding home in Oroville, California. So, damn, that's crazy. She divorced him while he was out on duty. So in 1944, she returned. Well, I mean, I understand that. I just thought that's weird, especially for that time. Like, he must have sucked. In 1944, she returned with her second husband to take just the girls, and leaving Arthur behind as some sort of revenge on Curly, which is sadistic. And
both of these parents deserve to be in jail.
I mean, the guy got dumped while he was in the army. But he took his
kid. Like, we'll get to it. This is the problem that I have with the dad. But yeah, you're 100% correct. I wasn't giving enough thought to the mom. Fuck that mom.
I think they're, yeah, I don't know. They're both
a little
rotten. I think
the mom is definitely, like you pointed out, a little bit more rotten.
In 1944, okay, yeah. So she just takes the girls, asshole. So Peggy's one of the girls. She grows up being told that Curly abandoned her family. And when she asked questions about Arthur, her mother would just change the subject. And she sometimes wondered if this brother she remembers even existed. So a couple years later, when she's a little bit older, in 1948, she's looking through boxes in the attic when she finds a picture of a little boy. Her mother confronts her and quickly takes a picture away with like no gained information other than her being like, okay.
And then she says she never saw that picture again.
Yep. At the age of 9, Peggy gets sent to a foster home, and age 17, she marries and has 4 daughters. All a busy year. She gets married at 17. I guess the daughters come after. But who knows? Over the years, she remains in contact with her mother, even though she's an asshole.
That's verbatim.
In 83, she presents her mom with this like picture filled like genealogical chart that shows like, you know, the family tree going back years, and she kind of uses it as like a hey, so what about that fucking dad and brother I have somewhere? But she's not.
Yeah, remember that, mom? Polite. You fucking bitch.
She's not as eloquent as I am. But yeah.
Pretty sly to use a scrapbook to guilt your mom into telling you where your dad is.
Yeah.
Hey, it worked.
I know. And she played herself.
It worked.
So she she gives in, and the only information she'll give is that her dad is from Lindsay, Oklahoma. So that's where she starts. The next day, she puts an ad in the paper looking for information on Curly and her brother Arthur. And 9 days later, she receives a letter from her aunt Velma, who is married to Curly's brother. And as she's like calling him on the phone, she's like, wait, I have a letter from my actual dad. And then she gets in contact with her dad, calls him, and the dad's just super happy to see her, to hear from her. So Peggy learns what happens to her dad. Her dad, after he gets out of the army, becomes a circus clown. And apparently he was a circus clown before the war as well. And he worked for Ringling Brothers and other circuses. In 1955, he performed just 5 miles away from their home. But according to the dad, he had no idea where his wife and kids were. So she finally reunites with her dad and stuff, and they're getting along, but they don't know what happened to the son because Curly had Arthur on the circus with him. Like, he was a child just, like, living on the road with his dad, the clown. And after a while – and apparently he grew up in the circus too, but a bunch of people got at him and convinced him that this was no place for a boy. Sounds like a
fucking Journey song.
Which is shocking because his friends must have been circus folk and
carnies.
And he grew up in the circus.
Well, yeah. And like the brief stint I did with the circus, like there were kids fucking everywhere. Like really? We had a school.
There was kids fucking everywhere? Not, that's disgusting.
Not literally.
God
man.
Damn.
Like, I mean,
just 9-year-olds circus, just getting in on.
Jesus. What the fuck is up with the circus? That's
why it's,
I thought that was Hollywood. Just kidding.
Like, the circus had the circus literally had its own school. It was a trip.
Well, yeah, but that was like in 2005, not the 50s. He leaves Arthur with Kes at a Catholic church, and they find him a home. So he has no contact with Arthur.
Oh, yeah.
Until years later when he just sends a couple of letters.
That's a better environment than a circus, a Catholic church.
Right? So they say for 4 years this kid was traveling the circus, and then he goes. So fall of 1948, he's turned over to this Catholic organization for to be adopted. And that's the last information. The only thing she knows is that he was in Colorado Springs for a little while in 1963 because he had sent Curly two letters, but he didn't include his name, his last name, or where he was specifically. And Peggy is still looking for him pretty much. She wants to find him. I think the weird, like, kind of middle, like, happy ending is that she finds her dad. But she, according to, you know, what we were able to find on the internet, she never finds her brother Arthur.
Her brother was ditched. He does not want anything to do with his family anymore.
Probably. I mean, she doesn't have anything to do with that, but.
No, but that whole memory thing.
Yeah. Or maybe he was just, maybe he died and, you know, I think it's a little interesting that there was like nothing, or maybe she got answers and just didn't do it as part of the show.
Maybe they just didn't open it up. They didn't investigate further on, and nobody ever asked any questions on the internet. So it's like, but after being left twice, first by the mom, second by the dad.
Damn, he was double ditched.
Yeah, dude.
No, dude, imagine your fucking mom comes and just gets your sisters. Fuck that shit.
100%.
So the next case is fucking crazy. We're going to be talking about a cult that I had never heard of, the DeCloud religious cult. And we're going to specifically be talking about a lady named Julie Cooper and what she fucking went through and how she escaped. This is a crazy, wild.
Oh, it's
wild,
crazy. 100%.
Shortly before midnight of September 17th, 1992, a young woman named Julie Cooper made an impassioned phone call, a cry for help to Tim Santee, a virtual stranger whom she had met only once when he repaired the satellite dish on the farm where she lived.
When can you come pick me up?
Nelson DeCloud is a former police officer, then a current piece of fucking shit. And he was a leader of a religious cult in Liberty, Missouri. Stack mentions David Koresh at the beginning. He calls him David Koresh. Koresh. David Koresh. And he talks about the Branch Davidians and, you know, they're sort of similar but smaller. And he talks, you know, he mentions, you know, how that ended very recently when this episode was aired in 1993. It happened not very long before that. So DeCloud's father apparently creates this cult in 1968. And before his dad, Forrest, dies in 88, Nelson ascends to the role of spiritual leader. So he moves his followers into an isolated farm in Liberty. And all of the family members are encouraged to change their last names to his, DeCloud. And he thought the lady says he thought he was one of God's sons. Like, he wasn't Jesus. He was just like Jesus's brother. And Julie Cooper was just 6 years old in the 70s when her family joined the cult. As we find out, you know, he was a repulsive piece of shit. And he wanted people to express their devotion to him in some pretty fucked up ways.
Dude, yeah.
So let's start talking about some fucked up shit now. Okay. When she's 10 years old, she's allegedly forced to watch have sex with a female member.
Trigger warning.
Trigger warning. True crime podcast. Hey, trigger warning. We're going to be talking about murder. We just made jokes about child sex. Like, we were laughing about child sex 5 minutes ago. What are you? Trigger warning. Just kidding. No, yeah, this is some pretty awful, heinous shit. So, when she was 10 years old, DeCloud allegedly forced her to watch him have sex with an adult family member because she wouldn't have sex with him. She refused. So I guess he was like, look how fun this is. That probably didn't work. At the time, she was like a tiny child. And then they talk about this really cold day. He takes her outside and forces her to stand alone in a field for like 8 hours until he like finally comes and says and until she's like basically ready to like give in and have sex with this old fucking man. So she stands out in the field until she freezes, and then she just reluctantly gives in to this piece of shit. And then Julie also said that at that point, another member like stood up and was, you know, kind of stood up for her. It was like, this is fucked up. And then she was like publicly humiliated in front of everyone else. And I guess that means cutting her hair.
They cut all her hair off.
The reenactment was – it's really fucked up, but the reenactment was insanely silly. Like, she had this, like, crazy huge wig, and then when they show her after her all of her hair has been cut off, it's, like, it's kind of funny. And then he's clearly not really cutting her hair in the scene, but it's fine. It's Unsolved Mysteries. It's super heinous. Up for Julie, so she thinks this is all her fault, you know. So she virtually becomes this sex prisoner for like most of her childhood, pretty much. And there's some other women too. A lot of other there's other girls and women that are also his frequent sex partners. When Julie's 15, this is when she tries to escape the first time. She runs away and. Her and DeCloud and some other members track her down really quick. And she's forcibly taken back to the compound in handcuffs. And that night he orders her to disrobe and then he beats her up severely. And I think this is the scene where it's so fucked up. What does he say? He's like, offer your shoes. And then she takes off her shoes and puts it in the fire. And then she's like, offer your shirt now, offer your pants. Like, slowly making her burn her clothes. Yeah, but saying offer, like you're offering it to God. Like, the shit people will do. By the way, have you seen Midnight Mass yet?
No, Eli? I heard it's good.
It's beautiful and terrifying. And it's funny because there's some Muslim faith in there. There's a lot of Catholic faith, a lot of Christian faith, and a lot of atheism, and they're all very nicely respected. And like you know, it's interesting. There, a lot of it is like you feel like you're going to church, like because there's a lot of talking.
I like that,
but it's so no trust, dude. It's a fucking masterpiece. It's a fucking masterpiece. Watch it. It's only seven episodes. It's Mike Flanagan who did Haunting of Hill House.
Then, yeah, like, it's gotta be gorgeous.
Dude, yeah, it's beautifully shot. It's all of your favorite actors from all of his stuff. Fucking, oh is my God.
Elliot.
I can't wait for Dan to get back Elliot, so we can Elliot watch a part it again. Of it? So I can watch it again. Oh yeah, he's the dad. He's the older dad. Yeah, if he's in all Mike Flanagan stuff. And then his wife. He's truly the anti-Rob Zombie because he makes horror with characters that actually have depth and you like them. And he puts his wife in everything, but she's fantastic.
Yeah. There's a reason.
unlike Sherry Moon Zombie. But yeah, Midnight Mass, especially talking about religion and the things people will do in the name of their religion. Misguided or not, and Midnight Mass is a really cool take on a horror genre that's been done to death, but to even say what that genre would be to spoil it, so just go and have a good time. It's beautiful and heartbreaking. Where was I? Okay, yeah, so she escapes, she's forced to burn her clothes, it's awful. And then it's 7 years until she has another chance to escape. Now we're in fall of 92. She's a young woman. DeCloud makes her contact a satellite repairman because I guess, out there they have a satellite. So she calls this man named Tim Santee, who's a satellite repairman. And the two start talking for a couple of days and then, setting up the appointment and kind of becoming friends. So one day he comes to the compound to fix satellite. And he says when he met her, he could tell there was something not quite right. It was a little off. And she saw Tim meet DeCloud. And when she noticed that Tim DeSanti didn't realize that he was the leader or didn't realize how special important he was, she was like, I think I can trust this guy because, he knows.
Yeah, she was like, he brushed him off, which meant like. He's like, yeah, because he's a repair guy. That's what repair guys do.
He doesn't give a shit. Yeah, he doesn't give a shit.
Dude, I'm just here to fix your shit. I'm getting out of here. And I just want to go to lunch
This is getting a little churchy. You just called that lady sister Julie, It's a little creepy. So she felt she could trust him. A few days after, I guess they were talking on the phone a lot. And a few days after, he asks her out, and she says she can only go out if she sneaks out. And midnight, September 17th, 1992, Julie calls him in the middle of the night and says, pick me up. And he's like, what? Okay. 1:15 a.m., she meets him outside of the compound, picks him up, and they leave as quickly as possible. And I think the girl who plays Julie in the reenactment might be sort of like a – she played Jerry Seinfeld's girlfriend. Or I don't know. I feel like
she had man hands.
a semi-successful actress. Like she's been in things. Yeah, I could be wrong, though. Anyway. Yeah, so they escape. At that point, she tells Tim about all the sexual abuse and how she's held against her will and all this shit. And, at dawn, DeCloud's already looking for Julie. He and some other people pretending to be police officers go to Tim's address, but where they ended up was Tim's brother's house. And, and they went in and this guy, what's weird is he was sleeping on a couch, in his own house. It's kind of weird. But anyway, he walks into the thing. They walk into the house and they ask where Julie is. And he's like, Julie, he's like, what the fuck? I don't know what you're talking about. You're not cops. Get the hell out of here. And he kind of picks up a bat and chases him out.
Can we talk about that reenactment where when they wake him up and he's just like, who are you? And the guy's just like, we're the cops.
Yeah, it was like a
Three Stooges.
I feel like I was watching the new Only Murders in the Building, and it was like Steve Martin and Martin Short, and they were like, I don't know.
I like that show, by the way. It's good.
It's so good. It's so good. Isn't it? It's a perfect mix of a good kind of modern.
I just
and then just that silly Steve Martin comedy.
What makes my heart happy is that Steve Martin and Martin Short are doing comedy together again. I love it.
Yeah, and those scenes where it's just them two, and you're just like, this is people don't joke, people don't do comedy like they don't joke around like this in modern movies. It's so delightful. Did you see the new one that was completely silent the whole 35 minutes?
No, I haven't gotten there yet.
The newest episode?
Giles and I started, we're on episode 6.
So the next day, the brother tells Tim about these people breaking into his home, and he and Julie realize that DeCloud is, you know, trying to find her still. And then that's when they contact the police and they report everything that DeCloud has done. And apparently the detectives for years prior had been pretty suspicious about DeCloud and those religious people up there at that farm. And, of course, she gives them the detailed account of her childhood in the cult and all the shit, all the abuse she suffered and stuff like that. But before even an arrest warrant could be issued, DeCloud gathered up all the women and children and several buses, and they took the fuck off. And then a few days later, I guess the rest of the male members left. So I guess we're assuming that he leaves with the women and children, like the fucky coward that he is, right? At that point, detectives believed that the group was still, you know, sticking together, and Julie's terrified out of her mind, doesn't think she'll be safe until DeCloud is caught, and she's worried about her family, who was still in the cult. It's very interesting to me, like, those fucking parents, man. They don't mention anything about her parents, but she says her family is still in the cult.
That's very, very much reminds me of, like, Scientology, and, like, did you ever watch those Leah Remini shows on A?
No.
It's sad. It's real sad. But there's a lot of stories like that. Like, they manipulate. They use, like, older people or younger people. Like, if you're an adult.
Yeah, but in Scientology, like, are they, like, were they, like, freaking raping Leah Remini's daughter in front of her?
I don't think they were doing that.
Like, what the fuck?
I think they,
like,
just take your money.
Yeah. It's crazy. I just don't understand what kind of parent would just be like, oh, yeah, this is father, you know, this is Father McCloud.
People just buy into some crazy shit, family. Dude. Like, people are sick.
Yeah, it's crazy how, like, the Bible is accepted, and then people can just, like, manipulate it into their own evil.
They just want to be in control.
It's like, the Bible is accepted. It's accepted religion, Christianity. Cool. This is a thing. But then people, like, twist it into their own, like, creepy, like, for their own measures and their own.
It's weird, man. People want to follow other people. It's very, very weird.
That is weird. That is weird. I don't want to follow anybody
either. You know,
I will follow you into the dark. I will only follow.
About to say that.
Ben Gibbard.
Death Cab himself. And I'm going to follow him into the dark. I was going to say you guys. I'd follow you guys to the dark.
The titular cutie in Death Cab for Cutie, Ben Gibbard. Is he? He kind of just looks like an English professor. I don't know. He's cool. I like him.
the elbow pads on the blazer.
Oh, yeah. Always.
Check. Go to bed.
Update. This fucker gets caught. Not that far from here, actually.
Where does he get caught at?
San Angelo.
Oh, really?
Yeah. People reported seeing his wife. Fuck, that's also weird. He actually had just, like, a normal wife as well.
He's like, I'm going to rape all the women in my congregation. And I'm going to have a wife.
And children. So, yeah, somebody spotted DeCloud's wife in San Angelo, and apparently the cult had settled into a farmhouse in the area. And when the cops got there, arrived at the place. Apparently DeCloud kicks out a screen on an upper bedroom window and tries to flee. But he's an old piece of shit, so it doesn't really work. He's quickly arrested after a brief struggle. The lady, it's funny, the FBI lady was explaining, and she was giggling. She's like, oh, there was just so many law enforcement. It was long.
This guy didn't have a chance.
He's extradited from Texas to Missouri. He stands trial for all the criminal counts, including forcible rape and sodomy. And since the arrest, a bunch of other members have started cooperating some of these awful things that happened to Julie. Thus, you know, fucking up his shit way more. And
good.
In September of 94, Nelson McCloud is convicted on all four criminal counts, the judge followed the jury's recommendation and gave him 220 years in prison.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
And apparently after all those years, DeCloud refused to appeal the case once. And he died of natural causes in 2014.
Dude, he got off too easy. He only spent 20 years, I think, in prison. That guy got off way too easy.
Yeah. I mean, he died a fucking old, dumb piece of shit in a prison cell, but...
Yeah, but...
That's still too good for him. Yeah.
Yeah.
They should have, like, fucking... They should have, like, gave him a knife, pointed a gun in his head, and be like, offer your fucking nuts. Yeah. Throw them in the fire. Nuts. Offer your nuts, you piece of shit.
Let's see if you're...
Offer your cock and balls. Sorry.
They should have torn it off anyway.
He's a heinous fucking piece of shit. Like, just to use... Fix
the punishment.
To use the loving grace of God... I'm an atheist, so if I, that sounded sarcastic, sorry.
No, it actually didn't.
But to use the grace of God, you know, all that nice stuff to, like, rape children, essentially.
Yeah, that's
like,
fucking... That's fucked.
Heinous. Yeah. So, yeah. That's, I mean, not a happy ending, but at least he got caught and is fucking rotting in the depths of hell. Hopefully there's like a smaller confined space in hell they could keep him for those 22, so he could serve the 222 years out at least, right?
Oh, they're probably going to burn and rape him there.
I don't know. Don't you feel like if hell is a real thing that everyone's just like, oh, you did that? Sick. Good job. Like, we're all evil hell people. Like...
They're, like, listening to just metal.
It's like, oh, how much oh, – what did you do? Damn, that's fucking heinous, man. You're immediately at, like, tier three. It's just like Vegas in The Stand, like just strippers. I don't know if you ever read The Stand.
You think it's just, you get rewarded?
It's Vegas in The Stand.
People get rewarded for being more evil.
I don't know. I mean, it would make sense. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm kind of using, like, Adam's Family rules, like – spooky is happy or, you know, whatever.
It is weird to think about. Like, why would the devil want to torture you if he wants be you like, just like,
you're my homie.
Yeah, burn in hell with him.
You're also bad too. Cool, man. Let's have a cigar. There's lots of cigars in hell, I feel.
And lots of blow. I imagine there's a ton of blow.
Yeah.
Like snowing constantly.
But it's only the fucking, it's only like the after effects of your body feeling like it got fucking wrung out.
That's all. Like you're coming down off of it.
Yeah, it's just the downer from cocaine. So, anyways,
no matter how much I do, I never feel any different.
Let's talk this a little bit about before we go. Let's talk a little bit about the loss. We got a little more info on this lost loves about Judy Davis and Becky Terry, dude. Judy Davis was the little girl with polio, and then the only girl who would be her friend was Becky Terry, and they fucking. Eiffel Towered that boy and just fucking they shared a boyfriend and, no just kidding they were really
Eiffel Towered the boy
yeah they were really good friends and one of them moved away like suddenly and Judy the girl with polio wanted to like contact her best friend growing up because she was a girl that was nice to her and then there, like the boy was her boyfriend at once at one time, and then Becky's boyfriend another time, and the reenactment was fucking adorable. I mean, the reunion, the filming of them getting together,
the reunion.
Yeah, it was nice. The cameras were there to see her literally like burst out of the car and run towards her and say hi to her friend she hadn't seen in years. It's really cute. And then they call the boy, and the boy...
I'll bet you never guess who this is.
No.
Judy Davis.
Judy, oh my God.
Yeah!
How are you?
I'm just fine. Becky and I are sitting here having our reunion for the...
Is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful. I can't believe this. It's the two girls that taught me how to kiss. I'll be darned.
Yeah.
Now the circle was at last complete.
And Robert Stack even says it in his narration that he's like, Bill, I forget his name, Bill met the two girls that taught him how to kiss once again, or whatever. That's so the one we did with Dan Derwin where he kept talking about handies under the tree. We're just like, Jesus Christ. Fucking stupid. But anyway, yeah, that was a little bit, it was like a part two to that update because when they originally showed the case, they just said like, yeah, they reunited.
Yeah, they reunited. No, don't talk to the boyfriend.
Yeah, we got to see it this time. But no, I think because we had Derwin on that episode and he was telling us, he was like, oh, it's like,
yeah, they show it later.
Did you see this part? And did you see, we're like, no, what? We didn't see that
no, part. What? He's like, oh, they must show it later. Mister, yeah. I got the deepest archive of.
Yeah, he has the fucking tapes.
Unsolved mysteries.
He has the tapes.
Catalog in his head.
He does. That's so funny. On the last episode, he was like, oh man, I was so drunk. I was like, no, it was perfect.
I still haven't heard it. I'm just glad. Oh, I'm so glad you guys got to do that.
That's exactly what we wanted.
Boring shit.
He had some funny shit about the biker guy. He was like, dude, his missing poster looks like the sickest punk show flyer. It looks like a Black Flag show. The biker dude, Tom Roach, I think. But yeah, this was fun. It's been a while since we've all three been together.
Yeah.
Dan's still on the road. Apologize for his loud audio. He's in a hotel.
Or shitty quality. Still working on it.
We need to get boxes. We need to get like a little like studio box. Have you seen him?
Max.
A little box.
Yeah, thanks for hanging out with us, guys. Thanks for listening. For every mystery, there's someone somewhere who knows the truth. Perhaps that someone is listening. And perhaps that someone is you. Good night. God bless. And